The new gender columnist for The Washington Post says the Kavanaugh hearings show we are in a desperately important time to be asking questions about what it means to be a woman and a man. Monica Hesse grew up in Bloomington Normal and is back to promote her historical fiction novel and to receive a Distinguished Alumni Award from University High School. More on the book in a moment, but Hesse says she feels the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings are not really about testimony over what happened 35 years ago.
I feel like I am watching a generation of women and men finally wrestle with and reconcile with the different versions of stories that they've been telling. My inbox is overflowing with women talking about things that they now see as assault, but that for decades they thought, well, that was just my job. It was my job to push him off. It was his job to try to get into my pants, and it was my job to push him off. And now they're really mad. Like, why should it have been my job all that time? And I'm also hearing from a lot of men saying, yeah, I did stuff like that. And it seemed fine at the time. A lot of my friends did it, but maybe it wasn't. So I feel like this moment is really about the stories that we've been telling about ourselves for a really long time and how we're going to figure out how to tell different stories.
Is it a generational marker? Are today's young adults in any way different, or are they still telling that same role-based story?
I think that today's generation is different. I think that there is a shift. I think that when the Me Too movement first started, you saw a lot of instances where it was daughters educating their mothers instead of the other way around, where it was daughters saying, Mom, that thing that happened to you, that's not okay. It's all right to be angry about it. So I do think that we're seeing a shift. I think that young men in the workforce today would never dream of doing things that we're hearing Charlie Rose do, for example, or older men in their 70s or beyond. I think that the question of how much we've changed will depend on how open we allow ourselves to be to the idea that we need to change. As long as we cling to the idea that boys will be boys, this is normal, then we'll just keep repeating patterns. We really, in a lot of ways, need to open old wounds.
But are the patterns repetitive in some sub-societal sectors? For instance, my son is in the musician/arts subculture,
yeah,
and he's appalled.
Sure.
But he says he knows people in the jock subculture, and they have exhibited some of the same kinds of behavior that are alleged to have taken place here. Is anything different, really?
I do think that we see that there are certain sectors that feel like petri dishes that keep breeding this again and again. Certainly, I think you have a lot of parents looking at elite prep schools now and wondering about the underbelly of those. I might be a cockeyed optimist, but I really do think that there are, with each younger generation, we're seeing an increasing number of young men like your son and young women like my younger sisters who are growing up with different role models, who are open to having different kinds of discussions. And like I said, I think change will happen so slowly, I'm not even sure it will come in my lifetime. But I do think that we're finally ripping off a Band-Aid that we've needed to rip off for a long time.
How will you continue to ask these questions after the Kavanaugh hearings are done and the vote in committee and on the floor are taken?
It's funny because I started this job 3 months ago, and even though it feels like we've been living in the Kavanaugh testimony era for our entire lives, Dr. Blasey Ford only came forward with her allegations a week and a half ago. I haven't yet been in short supply of things to write about. And I don't think that the topics will always be harassment and assault. I think that the topics will often be how we behave around each other. What are new workplace norms? What are new dating norms? What does a woman like Ivanka Trump mean in the in the aspect of what we consider female power. Is she a powerful woman? How does she compare to someone like Kamala Harris as a powerful woman? I think that there are, I think it's a pretty rich topic with not a lot of chance of running out soon.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Monica Hesse, the author of the book The War Outside. Where did you get the idea for this book, setting two young women, two girls, in an internment camp, one German and one Japanese?
So I had written a book a few years ago called Girl in the Blue Coat, which is set in 1943 Amsterdam. And I'm a really immersive researcher. It's my favorite part of any book. So I read a lot about the time period, and I was also reading about 1943 in other parts of the world and what was happening there. I came across a photograph that was, in a lot of ways, the most American photo you'd ever see. It was a young woman in a tiara sitting in front of a crepe heart, like a cheesy background that you'd see at a dance. And she had a sign that said Campus Queen. And I learned that she was the prom queen, and when the photo was taken, she was in an internment camp. She was a young Japanese woman who was the prom queen of her internment camp. And it made me really interested to know what kind of internment camp that would be and what kind of stories I'd find there.
A lot of people know about the Japanese internment camps, and a lot of people know about prisoner of war camps in which captured German prisoners were kept in various parts of the country, including north central Illinois, for one of them. But not everybody knows about people of German extraction kept in internment camps. How often did that occur?
The camp that I write about, the camp where this book is set, Crystal City, is the only camp that had both Japanese American and German American families. So there were a few other camps in the United States that had German American men. This was the only one that had women and children as well. And what differentiates it between the camps that you mentioned, the war relocation camps where Japanese American citizens were sent, is that this was run by the Department of Justice, and it was specifically for enemy aliens. It was specifically for people that the United States had decided were spies.
Families of spies.
Families of spies. And that's what makes the bureaucracy and red tape of it so horrifying and interesting in a lot of ways, because technically, when the women and children walked through the door to join their husbands, it was voluntary. When they walked through the doors to the camp, they were not prisoners. But as soon as they got inside the barbed wire, they were, and they weren't allowed to leave.
How are your protagonists, the Japanese-American girl and the German-American girl, alike and different?
I think that they're alike in the sense that they're both young women. One is 16, one is 17, trying to make sense of a world that's going crazy around them. And the questions that bring together are questions about patriotism and what it means to be an American. And how do you figure out who the real enemy is when your country has decided the enemy is you? And so I think that they have that common experience bringing them together, but they're from very different backgrounds. Margot, my German-American character, is from a working-class farm family, which was pretty typical of German-Americans sent to these kind of camps. Haruko is much more worldly. Her father is a clerk in a fancy hotel who was sent to the camp because the government believes he was using his job to pass secrets between hotel guests. They're two young women who would not have met except in these extraordinary circumstances in this bizarre place.
Part of the struggle of an author's job in writing historical fiction is to not only reflect the period in which you're writing and the aspects of society at that time, but to find echoes in present-day society. How did you do that?
One of the things that I find really interesting about World War II is that we look at it as a time of black and white, when we absolutely knew what was right and what was wrong. And when you go back and you read documents of the time, you realize that the people living through it saw a lot of gray, and they weren't sure if they were doing the right thing. As I was finishing this book, we suddenly again were talking about internment camps in Texas. These internment camps were ones where we were imprisoning migrant children whose parents had tried to cross the border. And what was fascinating to me is that all of the moral arguments that we were having in 2017 and 2018 are nearly word for word identical to the moral arguments that they were having in 1941, 42, 43, as they tried to figure out the right thing to do. So I always feel like good historical fiction is as much about the present, because it's about the pain and the heartbreak of America and the cycle as we continually try to get better.
Would you read a passage? One of
Sure.
your favorite passages?
I'll read the beginning of a chapter that actually a 16-year-old girl I met last night told me was her favorite passage. So I will read this for Nura. In the Crystal City camp, there is a federal school that is accredited so that the children who go there can have American educations. And so I will read just a page from Haruko's first day at the American school. "This is just a school," I tell myself. "This is just an American flag poking out of the ground in front of what is just a brick building. And this could be anywhere, really, except it's not." "You look darling," Chieko says, clucking approvingly at my rose seersucker dress. Chieko lives two victory huts down from us, and I met her last week, a few days after my family arrived at the mess hall. "It's Chinese rice," she said, watching me try to make sense of the strange texture of what they'd served us. "They don't understand there's a difference." Chieko plays tennis back home in San Francisco, she told me, and she has all the Glenn Miller records, and her father owns a film projector, which, she explained when we met, is used once a week to screen movies outside. The camp employees choose for us, westerns, musicals, and they keep track of what we like. I learned this at my first movie night, when a guard with blonde hair and freckles told his superior that my row had yawned 6 times during our screening of The Dancing Pirate. Nobody yawned during the newsreel that came before it. It might have been edited propaganda, but it was still a sharp, sudden taste of the outside world. "Can you tell your sister to walk closer with us?" Chieko says. "It looks bad, her being back there all by herself, like she couldn't find anyone to be friends with." Chieko is exactly the right kind of friend for me to have here. She lent me a pair of socks with pink trim because they complemented my dress. She's been here since the beginning of summer. She knows everything about the camp. I should be so grateful to be friends with her. "Toshi," I call, "come walk with us." My sister can hold a grudge, and she hasn't forgiven me for slapping her. Every night we've been here, she's dragged her cot away from mine to sleep next to our parents in the next room. And so instead of walking to the washrooms with Toshiko in the morning, I walk with Chieko, who knocks on my window before it's even light. Someone is always there before us, holding their piece of cardboard to use as a privacy screen. "It will feel normal," Papa told me the first day, when I didn't know about the cardboard, and my mother and I took turns holding our skirts wide to block each other's stalls. "It will never," I thought. A week later, I check the latrine for crickets, and I urinate behind cardboard. But I tell myself every time that it's not normal.
How affected are they at that level of observation, if the guards are even keeping track of their unconscious reactions?
So that detail is the kind of thing that I could not have made up because it seemed so bizarre. But when I was researching this book at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., I found, among other things, the notebooks that the guards had kept keeping track of how prisoners responded to the movies that were being shown. The Dancing Pirate did not get good reviews. So I think that to answer your question of how people reacted, obviously there was a vast difference in terms of personality and in terms of family. But when you read personal accounts or listen to oral histories, you see the strain becoming to be felt in horrifying ways. You read about children watching their parents' marriages dissolve because their fathers, who were used to being providers, suddenly felt helpless that their families had been brought here and they couldn't do anything about it. Or you read about children rebelling just to have anything to do within the confines of this barbed wire fence. One of the things that I always remind myself is that World War II was happening on a massive scale, but that doesn't mean that people stopped being people. They still had these petty jealousies and human emotions. And And I wanted to kind of explore what it would look like to have those emotions when you were in this magnifying glass of an experience.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Monica Hesse, the author of the book The War Outside, and a U-High distinguished alum. What does the pressure on these two young women do to the last couple years of their childhood and how it shapes them as they become young adults?
I think that you see both characters making decisions that they would find or would have found unthinkable before they came to the camp. Because they're being forced to make decisions beyond their years using what little information they have and the mistakes they make, which under normal circumstances would just be teenage mistakes that could be fixed with a little time, suddenly have ramifications for their entire lives.
Like what?
For example, one of the characters, Haruko, spends a lot of the book worrying about her older brother, Ken, who is a soldier in the Japanese-American unit of the Army, the 442nd Regiment, which was a real division. She knows something is wrong with him. He's sending letters that are increasingly strange and increasingly redacted, and she knows he's hiding something. I think in a normal time, she could go to her parents with these fears, but she knows how much pressure they are under, and so instead she feels that she has to be the one to fix it. She has to be the one to solve it.
Monica Hesse will read from her work, The War Outside, at Barnes & Noble in Bloomington tomorrow at 2 p.m. She's a newly named distinguished alum of University High School in Normal, a former feature writer for The Washington Post, and now the gender columnist for The Post.